Blog Talk Radio.
Green songs from a seasoned breath. As I burn on our evening bed of revolution, I, being black woman, know only the way of the womb, for I am deep, 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 deep red soil for our emerging black nation. And so, as I say again, and I probably can't say too often, that we do be about that, because in the past we've been other things. In the past, black women, black children, black people in general have not, as I say to you again, loved themselves. Black women especially have been many things in this country, and quite often when I talk to people, I always tell young sisters that you have to be more than your mama's was. You have to be more than people think you be. You have to be, because in the past, we have been this. We are songs yet unsung. We are music yet unplayed. We be black women. Yeah, 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 yeah. Singing in the night.
Happy New Year, Happy New Year, and good morning. Welcome to the first show of 2012. I'm Joy Keys, the host of Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. Thank you for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter.com/Joy Keys, and you can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. And you can also send me an email. I would love to hear from you. My email is SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. Thank you so much for tuning in. I really appreciate your support. This is going into the fourth year of the show. And this morning I'm going to be speaking with the illustrious, amazing, oh, my God, there's so many words to describe her, poet, activist, mother, nurturer, Sonia Sanchez. Many of you know of her works throughout the years, from all the way back in the 60s up until now. One of our most recent books we'll be talking about, Morning Haiku. I'll also be giving away some copies of that book, so you want to stay tuned. I'm going to give her a call right now on the line, so please be patient. She's also now just nominated as the City of Philadelphia's first Poet Laureate. So this is a great honor, and this is a first for the City of Philadelphia. So please call in. The call-in number is 646-929-0368. If you have a question for her, again,
you have reached 219-829-84.
Okay, let me try to call her again. She was getting some tea when I spoke to her early, but let me tell you a little bit about her for those of you who may not be familiar with her. She has lectured at over 500 universities and colleges in the United States, Africa, Cuba, England, Australia, Norway, China. She was the first presidential fellow at Temple University. She is a recipient of a National Endowment for the Arts, the Lucretia Mott Award for so many awards she's won. She's a lifetime member of the NAACP. On top of all these different works, she has more than 16 books, her first full book of poetry, Homecoming. She's a mother. She has children. So while she's traveling and writing all these different plays and poems, she has also been a mother. And also she's a mother to many artists. One artist I had on, Ursula Rucker, she's like an adopted mother to her, and they've done works together. I'm going to try to give her a call again. Again, if you have a call or you want to call in, the call in number is 646-929-0368. And you can also tune into the chat room and ask questions in the chat room if you have any questions there. You may not know that her poetry appeared in the movie. Hi, Sister Sonia. This is Joy Keys.
How are you doing, my dear sister?
I'm good. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you for being willing to do the interview. We're on the air right now.
Okay, thank you. Right, how are you?
I'm wonderful. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too, my dear sister. This year's got to be better than last year, right?
I hope so. I'm praying for that. I'm praying for upward mobility and so on and so forth.
Got that one, right.
So you and I have been talking back and forth more than a year or so, just trying to hook up. Again, I want to say thank you for being on the show today. It's a blessing for me to have you on the show. I've had many poets, but you are currently the City of Philadelphia's first Poet Laureate. So how do you feel about that? Anxious, excited? What's your feeling about that?
Well, it's an honor, my dear sister, you know, and I come in the great tradition of people like Sister Gwendolyn Brooks, Sister Audre Lorde in New York, Sister Gwendolyn Brooks in Illinois, you know, Sister Lucille Clifton in Maryland, right? Brother Baraka in New Jersey. I mean, it's been a whole line of people who have done this, who've taken on the whole idea of poetry as important to a culture, to a city, to a country, to the world. You know, people who talk about issues and, in a sense, I guess, try to become the conscience of the city, the state, the country, the world, to talk about the beauty of ourselves, the beauty of people who attempting to remind people of themselves, who they are, what they must become, how they must walk on this earth. So, it is quite an honor, and I thank Mayor Nutter and the Arts Commission, the people who helped choose me. Sister Lorraine Carey is one of the people, and other people who, are looking at the city of Philadelphia, saying simply, maybe it's about time that we had someone who was a poet laureate. So it's an honor to be the first.
Now, as a poet laureate, you're going to be choosing, I believe, a junior poet to mentor them.
Actually, I'm not going to, they haven't been clear about that as yet, and I'm sure
because
it's the holiday season when this happened that they will get back and talk to me about that. I'm not too sure about that, who makes that choice. We have to sit and talk about that and see what that means. But you and I know that many of the older poets have always mentored the younger poets. If you study with me, you know that that's one of the things that I've done constantly, that when I go out and read, I take the younger poets with me so therefore they can understand, you know, what that whole system is about, what it means to get up on stage and to talk and to read to an audience, and what that means when your poems go into a large auditorium, away from a classroom, away from a smaller building or smaller room, what that all that means. And so I've done that, you know, with I've been on stages with Talib and Mos Def and Sister
Ursula Rucker.
Ursula, right? Next one, Sister Ursula Rucker, Sister Nzadi, you know, Bernice Reagan's daughter, Sister Toshi, you know, all of these people, you know, we've gone around with in D.C., Tony Medina, you know, up in New York, some of the younger poets who are poeting. The joy about being a teacher, you know, my sister, is that I've had the honor to teach the younger writers coming behind, and the ones who are writing in Philly and in New York and in Boston and Atlanta. I've been their teachers, their professors, and so that is really a joy. They kind of populate the country at this point, and also the world, you know, outside this place. So that part is very good.
Well, let's go back to the beginning, because you have a rich history in terms of your family and also in terms of your works. You have more than 16 books out. So let's
actually
start at the beginning.
19, right?
19 now. 19,
yeah.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
19, sorry.
Right,
sorry.
That's okay.
You were born in Alabama.
Birmingham, right.
And Roosevelt was president at the time. In 1934, there were three tornadoes in Alabama, according to the National Weather Service. Also in 1934, the Apollo Theater opened in Harlem, and Louise Beaver starred in The Imitation of Life.
Isn't that amazing?
Do you remember? What did your parents talk to you about that time? Like, did you have any memories of your father or your grandmother telling you stories of that time?
Well, you know, born in 1934, I have very little memory at that time. My mom died 2 years later, trying to give birth to twins. My grandmother, Mama will come and pick me and my sister up and take us to her place where she lived. And in that house were what we call three aunts, aunties. But they weren't really aunts. They were really older first cousins because they were the children of my Aunt Sarah, But in the South, because they were older, you know, we would call them an aunt, you know, aunt,
right.
as opposed to first cousin. But they were all, it was all a household of women. A mama, my grandmother, as the head of that. I do have memories of her, and also of my aunts, my aunties at that particular point. I have memories of my sister going to school. She was 2 years older than I, and I'm told that I cried and I performed all over the house, and because my dad was a school teacher, he called the principal at Tuggle Elementary School and said simply, "Oh, let Sonia just come along. You know, she misses her sister." And so they sent me along, and then when they got ready to promote my sister, and they said, "Well, now we need to leave her behind, you know, here 2 years," and the teacher said, "Well, she did the work." So they promoted me. So I, my sister never got over the fact that I was always tagging behind her in a school room with her. But that was the joy of that and the joy of those teachers who taught us so well. They taught us simply that we had to learn, that it was not an option not to learn, that we had to learn, and when we didn't get something, the teacher would keep you behind at lunchtime and go over it with you, right, until you got it, and then you were released to go and eat and run outside. Tuggle Elementary School, you know, was at the top of a hill when I first went back to Alabama years later to do a reading at the University of Alabama. I asked people to take me to see if my memory was correct. You know, childhood memories are always can always be off-kilter.
Right,
and sure enough, they took me back, and Tuggle Elementary School did sit at the top of a hill, and you had to climb up a great hill to get to it, which was some kind of metaphor there, I guess, right? I'm not sure.
Yes, a great hill. In life, we have so many hills in life. We're always going up and down and up and down.
Especially if you're black. You were black in that time in Alabama, you know. You were going to a segregated school. You were going to a school at the top of a hill, which is fascinating, and it took a lot of work to get to it. The joy about that is that a whole lot of children made that trek to get to it and to get that education there.
Well, you know, Sister Sonia, that statement that you just made about the trek up the hill and the symbolism of that, and that breaks a lot of myths, because a lot of people think black children don't want to learn, that they don't want to get an education, that they're not interested in paying attention. And this is at a time when, you know, racial tensions were extremely high, and like you said, schools were segregated. But the kids were making the trek. They wanted to be there.
And they were well-educated, too. When my dad brought us to New York City, right, and we put down, we were registered for the seventh grade, right, my dad they said to him, "We have to put them back because you come from Birmingham, Alabama." And that was the first time I ever saw my father get angry. He said, "They know as much as everybody else." And so he told them to test us, and they did. And they put us in a good class. You know, we were not in 7A 13. We were in 7AR or 7A1 classes, you know.
Okay. Yes,
you know, which, because the classes in New York went from 7A, A1, and R rapid to 713. Can you imagine? And we were put into those classes, and we knew as much as everybody else. So those teachers, those black teachers, those mostly women in the South taught us. I mean, they would knock on my on mama's door and say, "Here's some extra work for Sonia to do." So she makes sure she really understood what we talked about, let's say, at lunchtime. Because she lived in the neighborhood, you see, and that was what that
so
was truly all about. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
They were invested in your education. And you came to Harlem in 1943 during that time, World War II. There was also a huge Harlem riot. of a soldier being shot by mm-hmm. New York policemen. And also, just to talk about the migration of blacks coming up, I had Isabel Wilkerson on. She wrote the book The Warmth of Other Suns and talked about the migration of blacks from the South to the North. One of the things I noted in some interview you had, you did not have a Southern accent when you got to New York.
Yeah, that is fascinating because there were like some tinges, you know, some twinges along the way, you know, that I heard along the way. I always talk about at some point when I used to imitate Mama, her speech, sitting in the kitchen when she was humming, and she'd say something to me, and I would repeat what she said, and my aunts thought I was mocking her. And Mama used to say, no. She just likes the sound of the talk. Isn't that something? She is a wise woman.
She was your supporter.
The sound of she was because I was a terrible little child. Let me tell you, my dear sister, the prose poem I did about my grandmother, Mama, and about when those sisters, she was the deaconess in our church, the head one, I think, and they would come to the house to snap those beans and to do cooking for the next day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And wherever I was, I would run inside and slide behind the couch because I could listen to what they said. And every now and then I was, in quotes, I love this word, snicker. That's what Mama used. And she would shoot her eyes around the couch and said, keep quiet if you want to hear this, right? But if you don't keep quiet, right, I'm going to put you out, right? I mean that was like the whatever. So I kept quiet to listen. And I did a piece called Dear Mama. And I heard about women. One of the women would say when they were snapping the bees, right? Said the beans said, well, you know, Sister Josie is being her husband's beating her up, right? And there was a snapping of the beans, and one woman said, well, Mama would say, well, you take the little boy because you're still also breastfeeding, you're still sucking, and you can suckle him too, and you take the little girl because she's old enough to be and play with your little girl. So they divvied up the children, and then there was this silence. And so I'm sitting behind listening. I mean, I'm my sister. I remember sitting behind there listening. And one of them
said, hear the peas right now. I mean, I can hear as you were speaking about it. I have visualized and I could hear the snapping. And I remember in my household that my mom with the peas and, you know, different things that they would do on Sunday and stuff like that. But now you are a mother, and I want to bring up this issue that you are a mother.
Well, can I just say one thing on that? And because we had no psychiatrists, we had no social workers who came in to tell, you know, to help that situation of a man beating his wife. And so one of them said, I heard one of them say, well, you know, we have to tell her, bring her in and tell her about putting, in quotes, the hot water on the stove and the hot grits on the stove and the hot grease on the stove. And then we have to tell her about waking him up in the middle of the night, holding it and said, the next time you hit me and the next time you go to sleep, I'm going to splatter you with this, right? So I write that in the poem. And I remember... Yes. Listen to and the silence of the cracking and you know and each one go whatever, and you knew that they had been through that also too, perhaps some of them that anger of these black men who were unable to release the anger out in the streets or at their bosses and at the city or at the country, but they released it at
of
home.
Yeah, because the racial
right.
So they're releasing it on their women. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Yes.
It's an amazing moment.
Well, domestic violence is a very serious issue. I've done several shows on that, and that is so important. One of the key things that in domestic violence is control and isolation. Mm-hmm. And so what we talk about on the show is not isolating, that try to keep the connection with the woman. If you are friends with her, to let her know that you are there for her and that you support her, even though she continues maybe to stay.
Well, those sisters said, but you know, first you'll get mad usually because one of the sisters, you know, what happens when you say that to them and tell them what would happen to them the next time they go to sleep? They'll get mad and go stomping. Isn't that a great word? They'll go stomping out the house, right? But she said, when they come back in, they won't do it again. Isn't that amazing? Just amazing, you know. And I was listening to, and what Mama was saying to me is that if you listen, Sonia, if you listen, my dear child, my dear grandchild, if you listen, you'll learn that, you know, what you also must do when you get to be older, how you must never let anyone beat you. They might hit you once, maybe twice, but if they do it the third time, it's on you, you know. And there are ways for you at some point to move around it, you know, and circumvent it, right?
Wow. So you were just so blessed to have that knowledge.
Yeah,
because
Mama,
a lot of women, a lot of children don't have that support. The support of, one of the things I wanted to bring up is that when you were younger, and this is, you were a stutterer, but now you don't. There's no trace that I hear.
Well, you never, my dear sister, lose the stutter. You know, I always tell people the stutter is always at the base of your skull, ready to pop out, you know, if you give it the chance to do that. And that happened, that started to happen after Mama died, when she died, you know, in Alabama.
Yeah.
I became that very quiet, opened my mouth, and I was so traumatized by this great woman, you know, who loved me and my sister so very much, you know, who took good care of us, who took us to church, to Sunday school on Sunday, and to church all day, and home again, and then back to church at night, because she, you know, was in church all day long, but who loved us, and let me just be that little wild child. You know, I ran with the boys. I came in the house, and I have it in that piece to dear Mama. I came in the house, and someone said, you know, someone said, we're going to decide who's going to be the leader forever. You know how many kids say the leader forever? Can you imagine that at six or seven, right, whatever? And so we tried to figure out what was the thing to do. And so we went into my sister, my bedroom, and there was a high window up, you know, part of like going up to the next floor. And I got up in the window, and I said, I know what, the person who jumps out this window, right, can you imagine, and lands will be the leader. They looked at me, and I said, no one did it. So I got up there. The moment I got up there, they went running for Mama. They went running for everybody else, right? And I jumped, and I jumped far enough, because what I had seen was the tree. We had this big tree that I knew if I hit the tree, I could slide down. What I misjudged is that the force of my leap, I leaped too hard, and so I hit it too hard, and I slid down too fast as a consequence, and so I scraped my knees. Well, my aunts came out. Said, tis, 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 tis. She's just never going to be a lady, talking about me, right? And Mama came out with her apron on, wiping her hands before she, you know, helped me up. She said, you're okay. She looked at my knees, and she said, Ruth, go get something to wash off her knees, and go get some Mercurochrome, right? And she said, you okay? And I said, uh-huh. She said, oh, they came and washed off the knees and put some Mercurochrome. She said, okay, go play. She let me be. She just said, she let me be, and I went out running. I'm the leader, I'm the leader, I'm the leader. Of course, two days later, I had forgotten. You know, kids don't, you know, retain that,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It was just
yeah.
for the
yeah.
moment,
yeah.
right? But
yes.
That was.
Well, I want to bring up that about you being a mother, because that affects your poetry. You have some children's books that you've written. You have written poems about your sons. And the year that your sons were born, one of your plays was published, and also the following year, you had another type of birth, the birth of your first full book of poetry, Homecoming. How has being a mother affected your work, and how have you juggled being a mother and touring and writing and generating all this wonderful creative, you know, pieces of work?
Well, it's not easy, my sister, you know. It reminds me of the professor when I was being hired as a professor, and he was saying it's so difficult hiring women because women have babies and they mess up the scheduling. You know, I'm serious.
Oh,
and he said, because you know, he said, I, you know, when we have a baby, my wife stays home with the baby, right? So I said, you know, with my fast mouth, I said, I guess you're saying that I need a wife then, huh? And he looked at me and said, kind of like dismissed me. He said, okay, fine, everything's okay. We'll see you, you know, whatever. But, you know, I was trying to show him that just how ridiculous this whole thing was at this time, that, you know, people were concerned about women coming into academe, about women assuming the role of teachers, just as they were concerned about women coming into the clergy and women being ministers, you know, and still not priests, you know, but no, like right. bishops, you know, whatever, et cetera, or women being the head of women being CEOs, or women being the head of big firms, or women being president, right? Or women being president mm-hmm. or whatever. You know, we were at the forefront of that. I walked into a classroom. I stood behind a desk. I was a professor. I was black, I was a woman, and people had to deal with that. And it was an amazing moment in history, you know, and history. And, of course, I had children, and I had to maneuver that and try to figure out how, you know, have someone live with me. My Aunt Sarah, who had taken care of me also for a while in Alabama, came to live with me and to take care of my children. And so she was part of my house, you know, my household at that particular time, too. But that was difficult. It was a difficult, you know, when she would go home for vacation or she would get sick and then and the children got sick, then I had to, at 6 o'clock in the morning, try to figure out how am I going to maneuver my 8:40 class in the morning, you know, right, and those right. kinds of things really did happen, and you had to deal with it. Or when do you write? You come home from school, you cook dinner, you sit and listen to your children talk, you supervise the homework, you go downstairs in the basement, you know, here in this house, and you wash some yeah. clothes and dry them, and you pull out the food you have cooked on Sunday for Tuesday. You know, you put it in the refrigerator so it can defrost during the day. You go upstairs, and then you go upstairs to your study. When they're in bed and they've done their homework, right, and their clothes are put out for the next day, you go in your study and you grade papers. People forget about that part. You have to read papers, right, or read the poetry that people have written and make comments on it. And then it was only at 12:30 when you checked the house, whatever, made sure the children were covered up because the heat had gone down. You go in your study, and then and only then would you begin that whole creative process that said, now it's your time to write. My dear sister, I would write. The reason why I was able to do the amount of books that I did is that I would write. After all that other stuff was done, I was determined to write because it keeps me human. Poetry keeps us human. It makes us understand exactly what it means to be human, what it means to walk upright, what it means always to attempt to move in a correct fashion. I would work from 12:30 to about 3:30, and then I would then sometimes stay on the couch in the study, right, or get up and climb in bed, and because the alarm was set for 6:30, get up. So I went on 3 hours sleep for years. I'm serious, for decades.
Amazing.
yeah. And your body gets accustomed to it. My body is still accustomed to it. But if I go upstairs to go to bed or to see the news at 11 o'clock, I'm wide awake. My eyes pop open because what it is, my body has, you know, our body has memory. And
right,
my body
right.
has the memory that it had to come awake at 11:30 in order to do work, you see. And so sometimes it's very hard to say to my body, no, I don't have to do that anymore. I know. I'm retired from teaching. I can even write during the day, but it's very difficult sometimes to do that. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about, we're getting close in our time, but let's talk about your brother. Your brother, you wrote a book about your brother, Does Your House Have Lions? But you didn't write that until several years, almost 15 years or so after he had passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And it deals with AIDS. Your brother died of AIDS. And I've done shows on AIDS in African-American community. And supposedly, as of today, they have this young man, Timothy Ray Brown, who has been negative HIV status for the last 4 years. And maybe, quote-unquote, they've cured it. But African-Americans are affected the most by HIV, according to the CDC. In 2009, African Americans comprised 14% of the U.S. population, but accounted for 44% of all the new HIV infections. What did you learn in writing that book? And also, why do you think it took so long for you to write that book? Was it
I had done a poem
yeah.
about that, about my brother. I forget what book it was in. I think it was in, I'm not sure what book it was in, my dear sister, okay? But it was in mm-hmm. one of my books, I think.
The earlier one.
The I'm thinking of color now, the blue book that I did. The blue book, isn't that wild? The cover was blue. Isn't that wild? It came out of Africa World Press, that book, Under Soprano Sky. Under Soprano Sky
yes.
is the book,
yes,
right?
Yes,
and I
yes.
And the first poem in there is the poem about my brother. And what people don't know at the time, my brother died. My brother was one of three young men in New York City at Lenox Hill Hospital who had what they call a strange ailment, and they couldn't figure out what it was. They said it was cancer, and then they said no. Then they said it was, everything else, you know, from pneumonia to cancer to whatever, and then they kept saying no. So we knew when you looked at my brother, we knew that it was a serious ailment, and they didn't know, but they knew there were three young men, and we found out what the name of it was some years later when I was reading in the New York Times a long article on this thing called AIDS, right? And they had given it name, and what they talked about were some of the same symptoms that my brother had. Of course, what was so interesting, we went in to see my brother. We didn't wear masks or anything. I rubbed my brother down. I touched my brother. I did all the things that people do, when you are visiting
yeah.
to help, whatever. And I wrote the book, Does Your House Have Lions? Because I was someplace many years ago, and I read, it begins, that quote about one day in the late 60s, I was on the phone with Rahsaan and mentioned to him that just that day I had bought a house. And Rahsaan Roland Kirk responded by saying, does your house have lions? And I thought, oh my goodness, what a great title.
Yeah.
Does your house have lions? What a great title on many levels, that all of our houses must have lions, right? You know, we must protect our families, you know, in these houses with lions, right? And so he said, what? He said, lions, you know, like the ones in front of a museum or the post office. Because if you ever notice that very important buildings always have lions in front of them.
Kind of standing guard, in a sense.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, protecting,
yeah.
right. And talking about the history also, too. And he said, you know, concrete lions. My house says lions. Go get a house with lions. And Joel Doan talked about that in the Rahsaan Roland Kirk anthology. And I wrote that down. And so I began this book talking about my brother at 17 coming from the South in a green suit. and I thought when I saw him, you know, for the first time, my God, I got to get him out of that green suit, you know, if I do nothing else. But coming not to love his family, his northern family, but to help destroy and damn his northern family, you know.
Mm.
So I would be, and it's written in rhyme royal, right? Which is
right. I wanted to mention that, and I wanted to. Could you explain that to the audience?
Well, rhyme royal is a form that Sister Gwen Brooks also wrote in rhyme royal. She wrote a long poem about this young woman and her trials and tribulations with her husband, right, and with a city also too. And rhyme royal has a history also. In literature, in European literature, I took it because I knew that I was going to delve in a situation, my sister, that was going to be difficult to write about, and I needed to take distance from it to make it work. I did need to bring great emotion to it because the situation would give us the emotion as opposed to me. Given the emotion, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yes.
And the form
you mentioned that before, the form helped you
mm-hmm.
contain it.
It did not deform
yeah.
me, yeah. And the form is A-B, the rhyme scheme is A-B-A-B-B-C-C, and it's seven lines. And so let's say the first section I wrote talking about my brother coming up, I said this was a migration unlike the 1900s of black men and women coming north for jobs, freedom, life. This was a migration to begin to bend a father's heart again, to birth seduction from the past, to repay desertion at last. He thought his father had deserted him, and so he came not to love but to destroy, okay?
You have different voices in that. You have the voice of the father, the voice of the ancestors, the voice of the sister in the books. So we get different viewpoints of the situation.
But at first when I was writing the book, I thought, as the poet, I'm writing this book. Well, I'm sitting in my study one night, and my brother's voice emerged, although he was dead, saying, well, where's my voice, Sonia? It's about me. You're telling the story, but where is my voice? And I went, hold it. No, what is this? Don't you understand? I'm telling the story. But his voice surfaced saying, where's my voice? I need to hear me in this. If you're writing about me, I need to hear my voice. And so my brother's voice would be, Father, I despise you for abandoning me to aunts and mothers and ministers of Tisha tongues nibbling at my boyish knee. Father, forgive me for I know not what they do, moving me backwards through scenes of bamboo mass, staring eyes campaigning for my attention. Come, O Lords, my extended metaphor. You know, so
amazing.
I began that whole section. My brother talks about his emotion and movement, you know, here, and also my then extending my hand, taking him to an organization, New York Corps, that I belong to, taking him to Harlem to hear Malcolm, taking him to all the things that would help save him at some point and help him begin to move away from anger and the willingness to destroy a family.
I have sister Sonia, too. The things that we do for our brothers, you know, we really, really, my brother's younger than I am. And it's funny that the things that sisters do for their brothers, you really, you know, I ache for him, and I hope the best for him. And I can sense that in your story for your brother. You had hoped the best and tried to expand, you know, his life, you know, with joy.
That is so true, my sister. But my father said, I mentioned to him at the time, as I'm writing this book, Dad, it's killing me. I said, you know, I carry a rhyming dictionary around with me constantly, right? And when I change a rhyme from the book, the whole thing changes. I said, I don't think I'm ever going to finish this book. And then he got this funny look on his face. He said, you can't write a book about my son, your brother, without, listen to this, without telling my story, too. And I'm saying,
I said,
I said out loud, I will never, ever, ever finish this book. But it went from sister's voice to brother's voice and then to father's voice. He said, the only time you would understand my son, your brother, is if you finally understand me. And he says, this time, and I had written about my father on many occasions, right? And he says, I hope this time when you write about me, you get me right. Isn't that something? and so the first section of his book called Father's Voice would be, but he talks about, I put in my father's voice the information about my brother coming to my house to talk about his father. He said, the day he traveled to my daughter's house, it was June, he cursed me with his morning nod of anger as he filtered his callous walk, skip, hop, feet slipshod from 125th Street bars, face curled with odd reflections. The skin of a father is accented in the sentence of the unaccented. And that was the beginning. And my father began to say, he began to talk about himself. I realized that I had never really talked about his history. He said, I was a Southern Negro man playing music, married to a high yellow woman who loved my unhurt face, who slept with me in Nordic beauty. I, prisoner since my birth to fear, I unfashioned, buried in an open grave of mornings, unclapped with constant sight of masters, fattened, decked with my diminished light. You know?
Beautiful.
You know, and that was
You know, we don't know. Our parents don't talk. I mean, even my parents, my grandparents. I think I know more about my parents, but I remember trying to talk to my grandparents one day, and I said, I'd like to interview you and learn more about you. And my grandmother was sort of into it, but my grandfather was like, what do you want to know? And I was like, well, you know, just like, what did you do when you were younger? Where, you know, your favorite color? Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't want to do that. And they're very private. We have pictures now in my house. We don't even know who these people are because my grandparents never told us, myself nor my parents. So they,
but what you have to,
you know,
do,
they don't know.
Is that when I was teaching up at Amherst in 74, I had given my, these are some bright young, they were all men. Well, mostly, I was in an all-male school, Amherst College at the time. But then I had students from Smith College. I had Yolanda King was one of my students. She started to act, you know, up when she was in my class up at Amherst, right? Can you, isn't that wonderful?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And every year I got a Christmas card from Yolanda. And and this year I didn't get one. Last year was the first time I didn't get one because she died, you know? All these students were there, and I handed out their midterm. They were going home for break, and
right.
I saw them all looking at the midterm, you know, and these essays or these questions I gave them, and they put it in. And then I said, give it back to me. And I said, when you go home, this is 74, don't forget, I want you to interview anyone in your family over 70.
Mm.
Anyone in your family over 70, over 68, 69, 70, I want you to interview them, grandmothers, grand-aunts, grand-uncles, great-grandmothers. And these are the questions. And I just off the top of my head wrote questions there. My students groan and moan because they said, hands, well, my grandmother's in a home, or my grandmother doesn't talk to anyone, or my grandfather, you know, isn't friendly, or I only see them. I said, then during this vacation of 2 weeks away from this school, you would then make a point to go and see them. And begin, and don't go with the tape recorder at first. Go and take them something. Take them some cookies. Take them some donuts. Take them yourselves. Take them your conversation. Take them, you know, whatever, watching TV
right.
with them. Then and only
just
then
being there. That's
can
good.
You then ask questions, maybe beginning of the second week. They came, and I still have those tapes. They came with some amazing tapes. Like they said, they came into the class like, almost agitated. You know, I talked to my grandmother, and she said that she was a Garveyite. Didn't even know she was a Garveyite. Had been a Garveyite.
Didn't know that.
That she got on a bus when she was being pushed off and spit in the bus driver's face. I mean, that was because these young people thought they were the baddest people on the planet Earth. And they found out that their grandmothers and grandfathers were the baddest thing on the planet Earth. Isn't that amazing? And they learn history and history about their grandmothers and grandfathers that they could keep all their lives, and they could play it, you know, after they were dead, after they were, you know, they had made transition. It was part of their family repertoire, you know. It was just amazing.
It's very important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, Sister Sonia, I want to jump a little bit. We only have a couple of minutes. I want to talk about your latest book, Morning Haiku.
Okay.
Can you explain to the audience what is a haiku, and how do you go about creating a haiku?
Right. Well, you know, the old way of talking about the haiku is that you would always talk about it as a profound moment, you know, in nature,
okay.
when you saw a sunset happen, right, or the dawn happening, right, or something happening in nature, that split second in which things are quite profound, a significant moment, and we taught it in the old way that three lines. The first line is five syllables, right? The second line is seven syllables, and the third line is five syllables for a total of 17 syllables, right? But
okay.
I don't teach it that way. You know, when I began to learn more about the haiku, you know, and what it is really all about, and how we are really, when we teach the haiku, we are really trying to teach a haiku way of life. Right? What I'm trying to talk about is that, yes, you will write this haiku, the split second in which things are profound, a significant moment, poems that explode from clouds and seeds and rain, poems that fly on clouds, you know, and the breeze and the wind. But also you teach the idea that the haiku gives us the unity. The light of the world is captured and released. But when it's captured and released, it disappears as soon as it arrives. Isn't that something?
Mm.
And so what
wow.
you began to talk to your students about in terms of this thing called, this thing called the haiku, is that you also begin to let them understand simply that you are going to model yourself after the form. You become mindful of nature. If you write a haiku poem about sunset or a butterfly, right, then you're
yeah.
writing about the nature of yourself. You learn the form, then you can bend or make that form fit your eyes and your touch and your smile. The beauty of the butterfly is haiku life, right? A piercing image of beauty. Then it disappears, it's gone, but not our memory of it. Our memory mm. is there at some particular point. So this haiku, the way I teach it with exercises, I teach the children and adult children and how to breathe. You breathe from your stomach. You know, when you inhale, your stomach expands. You know, when you then blow it out, right? You know, you exhale, right? Right?
Yes, yes.
You know, the stomach goes in, right? That's right, because we all have learned how to breathe from our chest and our noses and our throats. When you begin to think in the form, not about writing a haiku, you begin to model yourself after the form. You become mindful of nature, and then you become mindful of the nature of yourself. And when you learn the form, you know, then you make that form, you bend that form. So you teach the children how to touch each other's heart. You get a partner, and you ask them. And I did this with the mayor, you know, when I was talking about the haiku. You take your right hand, and I put my right hand on the mayor's heart. He put his right hand on my heart. Then I took my left hand and covered his hand, and he took his left hand. And I said to everybody in the room, keep quiet. We're going to hear each other's heartbeat. When you hear each other's heartbeat, my dear sister, you hear and see a human being. And you're less mm-hmm. prone to want to kill that person, right? You know, so, it is very Zen-like in a sense, and it is for us to experience the essence, you know, to be at one with ourselves. So the haiku teaches us to be mindful of nature and the nature of ourselves, and to be mindful of the nature of others, which means then we will not hurt and say terrible things about each other, but also we will nurture the other human beings on this earth. And part of that I wanted to say, too, then, is why I said to people when they wanted to do a mural, I said, let's do a peace mural here in Philadelphia. And I call it Peace is a Haiku Song. And people can send to Mural Arts, right? Mural Arts Peace, a peace haiku. Here in a place called Philadelphia. Isn't that amazing? So you want to have them write muralarts.org, right? And they send a peace haiku. And in the city of Philadelphia, already I have a peace haiku from Sister Toni Morrison, from Sister Maya Angelou, and from Sister Alice Walker. They've given me three lines that would be on this peace mural here. Odine Pope, the great saxophone player, has also sent a chord of peace. The great bass player, Kristen McBride, has sent
Kristen's my cousin.
I asked him to send a peace chord. The great pianist from Brooklyn, right, sent me a whole CD about peace, right, Randy Weston. So it's going to be not only the drawing of peace, right, but not only the words, the haiku of peace, but the chords of peace, you know.
Mm.
And then we will have kiosks leading up to the big mural. I'm asking to have, in certain parts of the city, sidewalks that would have haiku, peace haiku, from our children in the city.
Oh, that will be awesome. Yeah.
So when our children walk in the streets, they can look down and see that, right. And so, therefore, we're going to insinuate peace into their bloodstream, into their bones, into their fingertips, my dear sister, into their brains, but most especially into their hearts. We can teach peace, my sister. The problem is that...
Well, we need it because we have so much gun violence in the city of Philadelphia and across this country. We have more gun violence than any place in the whole globe in the United States of America. It's absolutely...
Because we teach
beyond.
War, my sister. We teach war and greed.
Yeah.
The thing about teaching the Haku, it has no greed. There's no fat or greed attached to it, my sister.
One of the things also is the juxtapositions of the two images, which also represents in something that you have mentioned in previous interviews, how we have two sides. You know, as humans, we have the good and the bad and the beautiful and the ugly, and all these things are all wrapped up into each of us, you know. So in turn, we should have compassion for one another because we all have these.
None of us is perfect,
sides.
You know. None of us is perfect. And I did a little short, essay called Haikuography, where I talk about the whole idea of that, you know, that, you know, at the end when we talk about, you know, what is this thing called the haiku, this haiku, and you go on. I talk about the reason why the haiku is so important because it slows us down. It makes us stay alive. When you teach children in these schools how to breathe with that one breath, you know, that it takes to recite a haiku, then you're teaching them how to stay alive, right? And also you teach them how to maintain memory and dignity at the same time. So, you know, when they ask me about, you know, once writing a little paragraph about the haiku, that's why I said that, you know, this haiku is extraordinary and ordinary. That's what we are. We are extraordinary. And ordinary. And we're ordinary.
Well, Sister mm-hmm. Sonia Sanchez, mm-hmm. you are extraordinary, and you have touched so many lives, and I wish that you continue to touch so many lives,
thank you,
young
my sister.
And old, in the middle. Thank you for being on the show today. It's been an honor, a true honor. I mean, wow.
Thank you. And you keep up the good work, my dear sister. And when you get a chance, would you send me a copy of the of this show, if you don't mind?
Oh, definitely. I will.
Thank
I can
you.
Put it on the CD for you.
Sure.
Thank
I
you
appreciate
so much.
That. Much
have a
happy New
Saturday.
Year to you, and have a great Saturday also, my dear sister.
Okay.
Peace
Thank
to
you.
You. Mm-hmm.
Okay, peace. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I just got off the phone with Sister Sonia Sanchez. Absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. Please listen and put your hand on your heart while you're listening. You can follow me on Twitter.com/Joy Keys. You can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. Also, send me an email. I would love to hear from you. My email is SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@Hotmail.com. Also, I encourage you to follow Sonia Sanchez on Twitter, @PoetSanchez, and check out her website, SoniaSanchez.net. Again, SoniaSanchez.net. And I'll be giving away a copy of her book, Morning Haiku. So if you want to win a copy, you got to follow me on Twitter and you have to become a fan on Facebook. So stay tuned for the chance to win a copy of Morning Haiku. I'll be leaving with the Sonia Sanchez, Under a Soprano Sky.
Tall as waves, sang in mixed tongues that loosened the scalp and my bones, wrapped in white dust, returned to echo in my thigh. I heard a pulse wandering somewhere on vague embankment. Oh, are my hands breathing? I cannot smell the nerves. I saw the sun ripening green stones for fields. Oh, have my eyes run down? I cannot taste my girl. Now, as I move, mouth quivering with silks, my skin runs soft with eyes. Descending into my legs, I follow obscure birds purchasing orthopedic wings. The air is late this summer. I peel the spine and flood the earth with adolescence. Oh, who will pump these breasts? I cannot walk my tongue under.